Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus in biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the BFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Bill Schott about his book, Bump, A Natural History of the Heart. In this lively, unexpected look at the hearts of animals, from fish to bats to humans, American Museum of Natural History zoologist Bill Schott tells an incredible story of evolution and scientific progress. Written with verve and authority, weaving evolutionary perspective with cultural history, Bump shows us the mysterious organ in a completely new light. Well, Bill, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
So as we're going through very tiring and times of the recent global pandemic, I was just wondering if you could start by reflecting on how has it affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience.
That's a really good question. And to tell you the truth, I've been involved in a lot of interviews with my book Pump, but that's the first time that question came up. The first thing that comes to mind is that not necessarily for the book Pump, but for the book that I'm writing now on teeth, I'm not doing the traveling to laboratories and interviewing people across the country that I was still able to do when I wrote Pump. But with regard to this book, I'm not going to book fairs. I think I've been to one in-person presentation. Whereas in the past, I was traveling all over the country, giving talks at libraries and clubs and book fairs, being interviewed at radio stations, and that's just not happening anymore. And I think it's loosening up a little, just a little, but I really don't have anything planned right now. I have one conference that I'm a keynote speaker in April. If this were some of my other books, I would have been a lot more busy and traveling a lot more.
And how did you find adjustment to mostly online meetings?
Well, I taught for 22 years, and when COVID hit, I coordinated and taught a large course in human anatomy and physiology, and we had spring break to bring that course online. And our textbook manufacturer, our textbook publisher, rather, put us in touch with a guy who was a Zoom expert. And he took us through and showed us the ropes. And by the time classes started up again, we were fairly competent on Zoom. And that's been, that's carried over to things like interviews with experts that I need to gather information.
So you already mentioned that you taught physiology. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I am born and raised in New York. I grew up with parents who were hardworking middle class types, and I always had a love ever since I was a little kid for animals and studying animals. I thought I wanted to be a marine biologist when I was really little, because I'd be watching Jacques Cousteau on TV, and he sort of became my idol. And so I always had a lot of strange pets back in those days. And I was the only kid I knew that had a monkey. And, I had snakes and lizards and every type of cool critter that you can imagine. And so my parents were really, they were really kind and supportive of this weird little kid that they'd had. I didn't have any brothers or sisters. And so I studied biology in college as an undergrad, and then I did a master's degree. And about 8 years after my master's degree, I'd been working in the pharmaceutical industry. I went back to school for my PhD at Cornell University, where I lucked out into the first of many really, really wonderful mentors, and began working on bats. And nobody was really surprised that out of the 1,400 species of bats that I picked the three vampire bats to work on. So I wrote a lot of papers, scientific papers, peer-reviewed things in journals. I wrote some, did some book chapters, and I was looking at locomotion in these animals that didn't have anything to do with flight. And that's because they're really neat, that they run around on the ground like little spiders. And so not a lot of work had been done on two of the three vampire bats, and really not much work at all had been done on the sort of quadrupedal locomotion that they exhibited. So I sort of became an expert on vampire bats. From there, years later, I got the opportunity to write my first nonfiction book, and that's because I lucked out and fell in with a wonderful literary agent, and so my first book was about blood feeding creatures, and the first half of the book was my work on vampire bats that I did with my wife and my coworkers and most of the stuff that I did at Cornell. But I was also lucky at the time, and a lot of people were unlucky, because what was relevant were things like bed bugs and ticks. So I got to write a lot about those. From there, I sort of found a niche that would allow me to take strange, misunderstood topics, complex scientific topics, put a zoological slant on them, and get rid of the jargon and present them in an entertaining way and humorous when I was able to get humor in. The next book I wrote was about cannibalism, so you got to sort of pick your spots there. And I looked at these phenomena, blood feeding and then cannibalism, throughout the animal kingdom, and then moved into how relevant they were to humans and things like human medicine and history of medicine. That was always very interesting to me. So after those books came out, and cannibalism did really well, Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History, my editor at Algonquin and my agent, Jillian McKenzie, suggested that I look for something a little bit more mainstream than blood feeding or mm-hmm. or cannibalism. And so so they gave me a list, and on that list was the heart. And I thought, not weird enough. Is there really a book in here that I want to write? And I said, well, take a look. And when I did the initial research, I found out that there certainly was enough interesting material, historical material, weird examples, that same sort of zoological bent that I put into the previous books, I could do here. And it actually even became more relevant, because, I'd like to have a dollar for every time I got asked a question that was sort of along the lines of, I've been studying vampire bats for 20 years. How is that helping my grandmother survive? But when I worked on the heart, the examples in the animal kingdom that I chose it's not an encyclopedia and it's not a textbook, were interesting, not only because these creatures had cool circulatory systems, but because they were researchers who were doing work on these animals. And we're talking about things like, this horrible invasive species, Burmese pythons, that are overrunning the Everglades. using creatures like these to learn more about our hearts and how to improve technology and treatment of humans. And that to me was a big surprise. So of course I steered the book in that direction.
You definitely are keeping a style. Heart is also connected with blood.
Yeah. It was a surprise that there was so much interesting stuff in there that hadn't been really written about in the way that I wanted to approach it. You know, the stories that I tell in this book, a lot of them have to do with improving your heart health, my reader's heart health. But I do it in ways that I think are entertaining and sometimes funny and are repeatable, sort of at the dinner table. Not because they're gross, although some of them are, but because they're unique. And that, you know, I've been really lucky to be able to sort of take this unique approach to writing that puts me right directly in the middle of, you know, on one side it's all of this really academic work out there that only experts would read, and on the other side there's a lot of sensationalized garbage out there, and I sort of set my sights on using my zoology background and my connections at places like the Museum of Natural History and other museums to tell these neat stories in ways that I think haven't been haven't really been told before.
And before we get into nitty-gritty of your book, Pump, you mentioned that you are the first generation academic. Is that right?
Yes.
And maybe you have some advice, or what would you say to students in your position?
Oh, find great mentors. You need to find people that you can trust. And when you find them, don't let them go. I'm talking about folks who are absolutely looking out for your, to benefit your, to grow you as a person, to grow you as a student, to teach you how to become an educator, to teach you how to become a scientist, or whatever the profession happens to be. But I don't think there's anything more important than great mentors. And you know, I've really, really been lucky. You know, I never really considered myself to be the smartest kid on the block, but I think that everybody has a knack for something, and my knack was always for connecting with an incredible array of people who mentored me, and you know, in so many ways. You know, and there's a long, long list, and I never, I never get tired of thanking them, and you know, and trying to be a good mentor myself as well, of course.
So your latest book is Pump: A Natural History of the Heart. Can you tell us how did you go about putting it together?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I start off in the animal kingdom, and I move through. You know, this book starts off with the largest heart on the planet, and that's the blue whale heart, and how the 9 of these blue whales died on the ice up in Newfoundland in 2014, and that's tragic. But we didn't really know a whole lot about blue whale hearts, because these animals, when they die, would sink. So in the old whaling days, the right whales were the whales that when you threw a harpoon in them, they'd float. Now, these were sort of the wrong whales, because when you threw a harpoon in them, they'd sink. My friends at the Royal Ontario Museum, Mark Engstrom and Burton Lim and Jackie Miller, you know, they'd heard questions from visitors to the Royal Ontario Museum, like, what's the largest heart in the world? Blue whale heart. How big is it? It's the size of a sedan. But they really didn't know. And when they got a chance to recover one of these hearts, because a couple of these whales did not sink, they were held up on the ice, and they came ashore in these small fishing villages, And they sent what was, you know, it was a half scientific team and half construction crew, because in order to get access to these hearts, you know, there was, for example, there were four people inside this whale pushing the heart out between the ribs. And they had to move this thing with heavy equipment. So that's where I start this book, and then move through how they preserved it and how they're learning so many things about this heart that they had no idea. You know, you figure this is a mammal heart. It's probably been really, you know, well documented. No, there are blood vessels that they found on this thing that they still don't know what they are. So the learning curve is really steep. And I try to get that point across about, you know, what science is and the approach that these folks took to it. And from there, I moved through the animal kingdom, looking at how hearts first evolved, how they're very, very different in animals that don't have backbones, invertebrates. There's a wide variety of different types of pumping mechanisms that send the liquid around the body, which is what hearts do. And this liquid is carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide, and it's carrying nutrients and waste products. And there's a lot of variation if you don't have a backbone. Once you have a backbone, and then I move into the vertebrates in this next section of the book, then there's a lot of similarity, because the idea here is that all of those vertebrate hearts evolved from a common ancestor, whereas the invertebrates, that just wasn't the case. You know, that we believe that hearts and circulatory systems in things like, you know, crabs and lobsters and insects evolved many times. Not the case when you get into the vertebrates. So then I moved through that, the vertebrate hearts, and eventually wind up with the human heart. And here is where you run into what to me were interesting problems, because our lack of knowledge about the heart was substantial and extremely long lasting. And so the reasons behind that, why did Western medicine hit a brick wall for 1500 years? To me, that was wildly interesting. And so I used the heart and what we knew and really didn't know about it as an example. And then from there into the improvements that were made, you know, cardiac catheterization, that story is insane. In 1928, this German is catheterizing himself. And there are people trying to pull the catheter out because they don't want him to do this. And he's, you know, getting him back of this, fluoroscope to take pictures of this, to prove that he's got this catheter. He can deliver medicine directly to the heart without cracking the chest open. You know, I couldn't write a fictional story that was more interesting than that. And then into improvements and cardiac medicine in the future. And the future is, you know, that's also got some really, really intriguing angles to it.
So let's start with a bit of physiology of the heart. So can you tell us what exact functions does the heart perform, and are they all the same across different creatures?
Okay, so if I were to call an insect heart, if I were to go up to a cardiologist or a cardiac surgeon and say, you know, this is a heart, this little thing, and these little tiny pumps in this insect, he'd probably laugh at me. These are not in there. In those ways, they're really not sort of like card-carrying hearts. But to me, a heart is a muscular pump that sends fluid around the body in order to pick up and drop off substances like oxygen and carbon dioxide and nutrients and waste. And there are a variety of ways to do this. As I said, there's a lot of similarity in how the how vertebrates do it. But when you get into the invertebrates, it's, all bets are off.
Is it necessarily one heart per creature, or can there be more?
No, for example, the squid have three hearts. They have two hearts that pump blood to their gills, and another heart, a systemic heart, that pumps blood to the body after the blood has picked up oxygen in the gills. So there's a variety of, you know, there are animals with multiple hearts. That's the one that comes to mind. But once again, if you were to call these structures you know, if you were to be, if you were talking to a cardiologist, that he might have different specifications for what he calls a heart. It has to have a specific lining. The endothelial lining of the heart has to be a certain, you know, it has to look a certain way. Otherwise, he's not considering that to be a heart. So, you know, there's a gray area there, but, you know, it was kind of like cannibalism. Some people considered if you walked up and found, if you were an animal that sort of wandered over and found the body of a creature in the same species and you ate it, you know, to them, that's scavenging. You know, to me, that's still cannibalism as long as it's the same. So there's, you know, it depends on who you talk to. But so I guess that's about it.
So you already mentioned some things about evolutionary history of the heart. So can you just clarify, are the old hearts that are present nowadays equally evolved, aren't they? So how do we distinguish what came first in the terms of evolution of the heart?
Well, I mean, you can look at the fossil record and you see creatures that are preserved in the fossil record that are very, very much like like some of the creatures that you see today. And some of these are so finely detailed. Some of the fossils that come out of places like China are, you know, they're over a half a billion years old, and you can literally see circulatory systems in them. So we have a good idea of what these structures looked like a long time ago by looking at animals that are related to those ancient creatures, and also the fossil record as well.
And what are the most interesting and curious aspects of heart physiology to you?
Oh boy, that's a long list. I guess the thing that comes to mind is, and the thing that surprised me the most, is the similarity between say the heart of a zebrafish, and if you ever kept an aquarium, a tropical aquarium, you've probably had these little guys in there. They're about an inch long and they have these horizontal black and white stripes, and they're beautiful little fish. But they are now in the 21st century, they've become the guinea pigs of the 20th century. And that's because they have, you know, their genetics are about 72% similar to humans. And so what we're discovering by examining zebrafish hearts is extremely relevant to what we're trying to do to improve cardiac medicine. So, for example, they just discovered in the zebrafish a cell that they did not know existed in them, and it is a type of glial cell. Think of glial cells, they're part of the nervous system, but they're not neurons. The neurons are the superstars of the nervous system, and glial cells are the support team. And this is a cell that they've never discovered it, that this is a brand new cell. And they think that it's involved in generating heartbeat inside the heart. And lo and behold, they're now able to, because they found them in these zebrafish, they've now discovered that they exist in humans. So this to me is, you know, this is the thing that sort of jumps out at me as really intriguing about cardiac physiology, is what we're learning from creatures that you wouldn't necessarily think would be able to tell us a lot about how to improve our how to improve medicine, for example.
Yes, pythons. For sure. This is super fascinating.
Yeah, pythons are another example. I mean, who knew that the million pythons that are overrunning the Everglades have got hearts that are, you know, after they have a meal, they grow 40% in size. When we think of enlarged hearts, that's a bad thing. But this is healthy heart growth. And what is it about what is it that pythons have that enables their hearts to grow in a healthy manner after they've eaten a meal? And this is the type of thing that, you know, there are researchers now who are trying to apply this to instances where, let's say you have let's say you have serious heart problems and you can't undertake the exercise regimen that you would normally take if you were to have a heart attack, and you want to exercise because that's going to strengthen your heart. But what if your heart is so weak that you can't exercise? Is there something that we can give you that would promote healthy heart growth? Well, it's taking place in Burmese pythons. So maybe we can use that those substances to promote healthy heart growth in people who just can't exercise. That to me is the, you know, that was, that's incredibly fascinating. And so, so the learning curve when I wrote this book was, you know, wildly steep, but what I found were so many interesting stories and so many that I thought were relevant to my readers.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what kind of diseases can afflict the heart?
Well, I mean, the one that everybody talks about is you know, atherosclerosis, and the heart is mostly muscle tissue. There's connective tissue there. There's sort of a framework of connective tissue, like almost like a skeleton for the muscle to attach itself to. But cardiac muscle is just like any other cell. It requires oxygen and it produces waste products, which it needs to get rid of. It also produces carbon dioxide, the cells do, and that needs to be gotten rid of. And you got to bring nutrients in to feed it. So not only is the heart a pump that pumps blood to the rest of the body, but the heart needs to be supplied itself. And in order to do that, there are a number of coronary vessels that literally come off of the heart and supply the heart itself. So rather than 100% of the blood coming out of the heart going to the body, let's say, and I'm just picking this number, let's say 98% of it does, and 2% of it goes to the heart itself. It might be more than that. But in any event, those vessels are really small. Those coronary vessels are really small, and they have a tendency to get clogged up. Or something that can happen is that there can be a blood clot that gets stuck that blocks those vessels. And when that occurs, when you cut off blood flow, and let's say that there were four of these coronary arteries, and they're each supplying different regions of the heart, when you block that vessel, then the tissue, the cells that are downstream of that blockage, and I'm talking about cardiac muscle cells, are going to starve, and eventually they're going to die. And the horrible thing is that when they, even if you were to get rid of the blockage, to you know, get the blood flowing again to that region, that if those cells are damaged, then when they grow back, they don't grow back as healthy, contractile, functioning cardiac muscle cells. You can think of them as scar tissue. They don't work. They don't contract. So this is a huge, huge problem. I mean, there's a list of problems that you have with the heart, from conduction problems like the electrical, you know, think of it as a short circuit in your heart so that the muscles don't get the signal to contract in a synchronously in a manner that's repeatable hundreds and thousands and thousands and millions of times over a lifetime. So that's a whole nother story. But, you know, going back to this idea of a heart being damaged by blood flow being cut off. If you go back and look at that zebrafish, right? You can snip off 20% of its heart.
Mm.
Snip it off. And that heart will grow back to be completely functional. Now, what is it about the zebrafish heart that allows it to heal itself? And the human heart can't do that. So this is where, you know, this to me is the fascinating thing. You know, there are a lot of researchers who are trying to figure this out. So that's just one example of a very, very common disease. And the reason this takes place is are things like diet and lack of exercise and genetics as well. But how we're trying to approach it in very, very new ways, you know, and up till recently, it's just been, well, we're going to replace that vessel. So they'll take a vessel off of your leg or your arm and they'll do a bypass surgery. Well, in the future, they may not have to do that. So this to me is what's exciting.
Okay, so let's look at some of the medical discoveries and developments over history. So which ones do you find most exciting?
Well, the ones that I talk about are things like the stethoscope, which I think they did a poll of the medical instrument that makes you most trust a physician when you see him, and this is still the stethoscope, and this is something that was invented in 1816 by a Frenchman by the name of René Laennec. And he was living in Paris when there was a horrible outbreak of tuberculosis. And back in those days, they called it consumption because it consumed this. It was this disease that seemed to consume you from within. The legend has it is that he was walking through a square and he saw two kids playing, and one of them had a stick and he was holding it up to his ear and the other kid was tapping the far end of the stick. And he just got the idea that the way to examine people back in those days was you just would put your ear to their chest. And this was problematic because of things like, fleas and unsanitary conditions, and then there was the whole idea of a male doctor putting his head on against the breast of a lady, and this was sort of frowned upon. So he thought in terms of using an instrument, and he didn't use a stick. He something more like a straw, enlarged that by 10 times, and that he could put his ear against and put that to the chest of his patients. And how they were first using it was to detect accumulations of liquid in the lungs because of tuberculosis. But it was also used to and has been used to listen to heart sounds. And it was just one more tool that doctors could use to get sort of a standard measurement of a normal heartbeat, and then compare it to the heartbeat of folks who were suffering from various maladies. And so it became a very, very important and still is instrument. So I talk about that. I talk about cardiac catheterization, which is a crazy story. There's a list of neat instruments and that I go through, as well as procedures like transplants, and I spend quite a bit of time looking at a transplant. You know, the first heart transplant was in 1967. The first artificial heart was in 1982. Both of these were problematic for various reasons that I talk about, not enough donor hearts being one, and the mechanical hearts were always sort of going to be temporary. But in 1984, Leonard Bailey transplanted the heart of a baboon, an infant baboon, into a deathly ill child, newborn, who became known as Baby Faye, and got a tremendous amount of media coverage there. And long story short, Baby Faye died right at around 3 weeks, but not because her body rejected that heart. She died for other reasons. She was, as I said, desperately ill. So that was a tragedy. But what it did, because of the media coverage, it led to an explosion in research on things like transplants in newborns. And Leonard Bailey never had to do another baboon to human transplant again, because the media and the coverage that he received, then donations started to come in when people lost their infants. They would donate their hearts. And meanwhile, other researchers looked for ways to approach the cardiac disease that baby Faye had and other similar type diseases of newborns, and ways to approach curing them without transplants. So there was this, what started out as a tragedy turned into just all sorts of improvements and techniques and new methodologies. So I tell that story as well. And, you know, I was fascinated by it.
Yes, for sure. And it's one of those aha moments for science, and the development of it just led to so much good, isn't it, later on?
Oh, absolutely.
So as in those days, today as well, we usually have sort of lack of donor hearts available mm-hmm. to all of the people. So there are some developments to start using perhaps humanized animal hearts. So can you tell us a little bit about these technologies?
Yeah, I mean, right now, just recently in the news, there's been a lot about transplanting animal organs into humans, and the one that came up recently is the transplantation of a kidney into a woman who was literally brain dead and being kept alive, and it was a pig kidney, and that was a strain of pigs that had been genetically adjusted in a sense by this sort of CRISPR technology that has now become really popular, where you can go in and cut out parts of a genetic code that would, for example, produce substances in that pig and the pig's heart that your body would reject. So they're editing these things out, and what they produced was a kidney in this instance that had been gone through this procedures in these pigs to produce a kidney that would not be rejected, and it wasn't. So that's certainly one aspect of transplantation in the future is to use genetically modified pigs, and their hearts are very similar to humans. They would never use chimpanzee hearts or baboon hearts because they don't really, you know, they don't produce a lot of offspring, whereas pigs would produce more hearts. There are very, very different ways that researchers are looking to approach the problem of not enough donor hearts. And I was lucky enough to go up to Harvard and go into the laboratory of Dr. Harold Ott. And what he is doing is something very, very different. What he's saying is, if you pass away and you're going to donate your heart, if you pass away and you're going to donate your body to science, but instead of doing that, donate your heart to a facility. And this facility will take your heart after you pass away. And he's doing this now with non-human hearts. Literally take this heart. Now, if I were to take that heart and put it into somebody, transplant it into them, it would have to be the right tissue type. It would have to be the right blood type. These are sort of the problems that you run into with transplants in that, you know, it's not like every heart can go into every person. You know, a donor heart doesn't necessarily going to go into this recipient. What he's doing is he's taking these cadaver hearts and then running them through a process that is literally a substance that's dripping through the heart like a detergent. And instead of cleaning like a detergent would do, this detergent is literally washing away all of the cells in the heart that your body would reject if you put that heart into a person. And what's left is connective tissue. What's left is mostly collagen. And you do not react. The human body does not react. Your immune system does not reject collagen like it would muscle cells and muscle tissue. So what he's left with is this ghostly white skeleton of a heart. a model, as it were, a scaffold. And now what he wants to do is, let's say that you're going to get a heart transplant. So you're going to be the recipient. He takes a sample from your skin. So he's not doing any kind of, you know, biopsy where they have to go in deep. He's taking a skin sample. And from that skin sample, he's taking cells called fibroblasts. And the technology now exists to turn those fibroblasts, normal skin cells, into stem cells. And stem cells, as you know, literally can turn into any type of cell in the body depending on how the body stimulates them. Well, we can also now take stem cells and stimulate them to become muscle cells or kidney cells. So that technology exists. So what he wants to do is take these recipient cells from this eventually who's going to be a cardiac recipient, take them, convert them into, take these fibroblasts, convert them into stem cells, convert the stem cells into cardiac muscle cells, then culture those cells, grow them, and eventually put them back onto that scaffold and to literally grow a heart to order for the recipient that is made up of his own cells with a framework of connective tissue, and then install that, transplant that into someone's body. So I was completely blown away by this by this technology. I said, so how long do you think this is going to take before this happens regularly? He says, within 10 years.
I love it when the science fiction starting to sound like science reality.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I could go on. There were other examples in other laboratories that I visited that would just blew my mind when I saw what was going on. And you know, you mentioned earlier about why, you know, how the pandemic has affected me. You know, you can't really go into those laboratories anymore. You can't make those visits. So it's a lot different if you're doing an interview via Zoom, for example, than being able to go into the lab and see those specimens and talk to these guys face to face. And that's what I was able to do for Pump.
And that's brilliant that you bring all of these insights to your audience.
I enjoy writing it, and I've always enjoyed teaching and getting material across to people that's helpful and in a way that's not full of jargon. And, you know, I'm not showing off big, you know, how many big words I know. I'm trying to get information across that I think is important in an entertaining way and in a way that, you know, was it the Wall Street Journal said that I've got a lot of dad humor, dad jokes in my books. So I asked my son, and I said, is that bad? He goes, no, Dad, that's okay. Yeah, that's fine.
It's in vogue now.
I guess.
So now thinking about all of these developments, is there anything that you would want to discover about the heart next?
Oh, next. Boy. You know, I think I've covered the examples that I think we need to keep following up on some of the innovations that animal hearts have to improve our own outlook. So I think that's important. I'm an animal lover. I'm a zoologist, and I realize that there are people who are sensitive to the use of animals, but they play an important role in the development of things like drugs and these technologies that we're trying to develop now. And so I just think that there's a lot to learn from as far as the heart and circulatory system goes, that there's a lot to learn from nature that will benefit humans if we keep going on those routes.
And also this collagen scaffold of the heart that you mentioned, of course you require a donor in this case, mm-hmm. but do you think that technology can improve for us to be able to 3D print this scaffold? And that we can use maybe on the long haul mm-hmm. space travel if we want to provide ourselves with new organs?
Oh, absolutely. There are researchers. There's a researcher who I didn't really get to work on this because I didn't find out about it until after the book was written. But there are researchers in Israel who are 3D printing hearts. And so, yes, they are taking that that tact as well. What Dr. Ott is doing is he's using cadaver hearts. These are not people who are, you know, who are alive and are donating their heart or donating a kidney or something like that. You know, these are people who are deceased that would presumably donate their hearts after they died. Just to sort of clear that up.
So now if we zoom out and think about the bigger picture, so in what ways are thinking about the physiology of the heart, but also heart transplantation are being shaped by the economic, political, or even social forces of our day?
That's another really, really good question. I think there's a real disconnect with regard to accessibility to things like healthy, affordable food, medical care, medical insurance, access to aftercare, healthy living conditions. That is certainly problematic. That is a real problem, and I think it is one that is that needs to be addressed. It is as important as developing new technologies, because if we can't get these new technologies and medications out to everyone, then I think, you know, in part at least we've failed. So yes, I do believe that this is something that is very, very important, that this disconnect between those who have access to things like great medical care and those who don't, and those who are eating unhealthy food and because they can't afford healthy food or because they don't know, they have not been shown what they can do to improve improve their diets, for example, and they have a distrust of science, or they have a distrust of government. And these are horrible problems.
Yes, for sure. And as we learn more and more, that cardiovascular health is so important to so many systems, isn't it? For the brain, for example, as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I taught, and I took an early retirement a year ago, so now I'm writing full time. And working as a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History, but I'd like to have a dollar for every time I told my students that you cannot look at an organ system like the circulatory system. You can't look at it like a book chapter. And unfortunately, that's how these things are presented, because it's not like you can just read up about this, study it, and then spit it out on a test and then move on. And now let's look at the respiratory system and sort of forget the circuit. No, these things are intimately tied together. And that is the way to look at these systems. That is the way to look at organs. Without the circulatory system, the brain is not going to work. Without the brain, then the circulatory system is not going to work. And there's an incredibly close tie-in between the respiratory system in the heart. And I could go on and on. So the way, and I really try to punch this home in this book is the way to look at the human body is not as a, not as a chapters in a book, but in interrelationships between organs, between organ systems. I think that's an important thing for everybody to learn. And the other, while I'm on this rant, is that we've got to stop thinking about our hearts, our lungs, our digestive systems as being somehow the pinnacle, the end all, the be all, the greatest. Not at all. All of these systems, whether you're looking at the multiple hearts that are found in an insect, or you're looking at the complexities of the human heart, they all get the job done. They are all functionally equivalent, and so to look at an insect heart as being somehow inferior to the human heart, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice. We need to get away from that whole idea of ours is best. And this is just a continuation of a line of thought that existed for a long, long time. And we've all seen these pictures of, you know, here's like five different, human ancestors, and they're all lined up and they all seem to be on a march to become the modern human, you know, the march of progress. Well, that's just not the way that scientists think that things work anymore. And so, now, these are the types of realizations that I try to get across in an entertaining manner in my books. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're looking at Dark Banquet, the book on blood feeding, or Cannibalism, Perfectly Natural History, or Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. The message is in there in all of them.
So what kind of discoveries along your journey to writing your book Pump surprised you the most?
The one that jumps out at me is that, I was investigating why we have these, when we think of the heart, we think about, emotion and intellect, and it's the seat of the soul. And so I looked at where that came from, the origins of this idea of, quote, cardiocentrism, end quote. And while I was doing that, to make a long story short there, when I was working on a book about cannibalism, I wondered why we have a knee-jerk reaction to that word. And when I did that research, I was going to name the chapter "Blame It on the Ancient Greeks," and that changed. But when I looked, when I went to look at why we have the, in the West at least, we have these feelings about that the heart is tied to emotions and memory and intellect and the soul, I could have named that chapter "Blame It on the Ancient Egyptians," and these are people who really put a lot of they thought a great deal about the heart. They thought very little about the brain. If they were mummifying you, they would pull the brain out of your head with a hook and throw it away. And the heart, though, was a different matter. The heart had to be preserved because it was going to be weighed in the afterlife against the feather of Mat, this goddess, and to determine whether you were going to have a good time in the afterlife or not. But at the same time, so this was adopted by the Greeks, who really held Egyptian medical information in high esteem, passed on to the Romans. Now, at the same time, the artists are looking at this, and the Egyptians are saying the heart is the center of everything. So that gets passed on to the Greeks, that gets passed on to the Romans. Now the artists are picking that up, and they're looking at it and going, "Oh, all right. Well, then, so their paintings and their poems and their stories are all centered around the heart." So I thought that was really, really intriguing. But to get away from that, the thing that surprised me the most was that a Roman physician in the second century picked up on what he'd learned from the Greeks, who'd picked up on what they'd learned from the Egyptians, and he wrote about 3 million words. This was Galen, and Galen's work, much of it was wrong. You know, he believed, for example, that there were that arteries carried air. And that veins carried blood, and that you had these four humors, and that you had to maintain the balance of these substances in your body, and that would make you healthy, which is why they bled you forever. You know, when you hear about people bleeding or put a leech on a guy, that was to balance one of the four humors, which is blood. The problem is that when Rome fell, Galen's work, and it was about 3 million words, was not initially translated into Latin, which was the language of scholarship, at least in the West. And it sat. And in the Middle Ages, when it was translated by Syrian Christians. And when they did this translation, they sort of interpreted that Galen was a monotheist. He was not a Christian, but he was a monotheist. And they added their Christian slant to Galen's translations. And when the church read these translations, which finally got translated into Latin, they fell in love with Galen. And so they decreed that Galen's writings were divinely inspired and that nobody could do anything counter to what was written by Galen. So for 1500 years, medicine came to a halt. And so this to me was one of the big surprises. And just, you know, this whole idea that is, you know, and it's so relevant nowadays about any type of a lockstep following of something that is not investigated is going to lead to trouble. And we see that today. So to me, that was one of the biggies. You know, that was one of the most interesting things that I found that while I was researching this book and I got to write about.
So now circling back to the beginning of our conversation when you introduced the whale heart, I was just wondering how much formaldehyde does it need for preservation?
I talk about that and how when we're in a lab situation, we're always worried about getting a little bit of formalin, which is the dilute version of formaldehyde, splashed on us. You freak out when you get this stuff on you. Oh my God, it's a carcinogen. Got to go wash up, and that's great. But these guys when they were doing the initial preservation, and this took 5 years total.
Wow.
They were using hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of gallons of formalin, so they weren't worried about it getting splashed on them. They were worried about falling into a vat of it. And then after this, after it was preserved, then they wound up sending it over to Germany where it was plastinated. And if you've ever seen the bodies exhibit and different exhibits with plastinated specimens, there'll be a specimen of a guy dribbling a basketball and he looks perfectly normal, except he has no skin and he's made of plastic and all you can see is his muscles and circulatory system. That's this plastination process. So they plastinated this 385-pound blue whale heart. And it is absolutely stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And it's on display now at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. One of the things they found out about it is a whole lot smaller than they thought it was going to be. That was a big, big surprise. So they wondered, why is this thing not much larger than it is? And what they figured out was that if you were to look at a hummingbird, right, and the heart of a hummingbird, if you had a, you know, the whale weighed 90 tons. If you had a 90-ton hummingbird, it would have a heart that was 8 times larger than the blue whale heart, 8 times. And they wondered, why is this so? But they came to the conclusion, and these are my friends, Mark Engstrom and Burton Lim and Jackie Miller up at the ROM, was that hummingbird wings beat at about 80 times per second. And in order to do that, their heart beats at a maximum at 1,260 beats per minute. And that's probably about the limit that a heart can beat. It has to fill, the heart has to contract, it has to empty. So the only other way to get more blood to the muscles of the wings, and that's what you really need to do here if you're beating your wings at 80 times per second, is to have a larger heart. So every time it pumps, you're sending more blood to those muscles and at an incredibly high rate. Now, whales don't need that. You know, when they're on a dive, maybe their heart is beating 2 or 3 times per minute. So they don't have those demands, those metabolic demands for oxygen and nutrients that something like a hummingbird or a little shrew, a little mousy looking insectivore would have. So that to me was, once again, that throughout this book, the learning curve was wickedly steep, as it was for these folks who finally got their hands on a blue whale heart.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Well, I've just turned in a work of fiction and I'm really excited about it because it's I have three novels and they're World War II techno thrillers, a little cryptozoology thrown in there. But I've written a novel. It's my first solo novel and it's for upper middle graders. And it takes place during World War II. And so that is done and submitted. But right now I'm working my nonfiction. I'm working on a book about the natural history of teeth. So, and I'm finding that to be just as interesting. And you know, when you go into the history of dentistry, there is some real strange, real strange stuff was going on. And then teeth have always been wildly important for people like paleontologists who are telling the story of life on this planet. Much of what we knew for a long, long time was based on fossil teeth, which are the most common vertebrate fossils by far. So that's what I'm working on now. And I expect that will be out in 2023.
And where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
Let's see. I have a website, BillShutt, BillShutt.com. I am also on Twitter at BillShutt Books. And I have a Facebook page, BillShutt Author. If you go on Amazon, there's a page there on BillShutt Author and also Goodreads as well. So I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. And I welcome questions from listeners. And I always have. And my book is available. All of my books are available in any format that you want. And they're available everywhere you can buy books.
Thank you so much for joining me today and for getting me really pumped up about the heart. Sorry for this dad joke.
No problem. It was a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for having me on your show.